All right. Thank you all very much for being here. Thanks in particular to our host committee for your kind sponsorship of this event. And of course, Tom DiLorenzo, the very able president of the Mises Institute, Mr. President, I call him from time to time. I'm going to be talking about bureaucracy today, and particularly the public health bureaucracy. But let's begin with this. The COVID years were not the human race's finest moment. So I know you don't say, but this is my considered judgment after looking at the matter. But so much of what it meant to be human was abruptly taken from us. And even though the evidence made it obvious that nothing they were doing was making a damn bit of difference or accomplishing anything for human health, that's for sure, at least half of America seemed to welcome the insanity. They seemed to be all too happy to snitch on their neighbors and render moral judgment on dissidents. I thought for sure that people would dramatically turn against this policy before too long. They implemented it in March, and I thought by mid-April, people are going to be going stir crazy, and that's going to be the end of this. And I'll tell you something. I've been right about a lot of things, but my gosh, have I been wrong about some things, and that was one of them. That was one of them. The other, by the way, the other major, major, major thing I was profoundly wrong about was back in 2007. I think Lou still has it on his blog. It was not deleted, even though it would have saved me a lot of embarrassment if this had been deleted. I posted that, you know, Ron Paul probably shouldn't talk so much about the Fed. It's a really technical topic, probably going over most people's heads. He should just avoid that. That is like the guy who said, we don't want to sign the Beatles because groups with guitars are on their way out. Like, I am sorry I said that. I was totally wrong. But I was also wrong about the human race. I thought the human race had a desire to live. And by live, I don't just mean survive biologically, because there is more to life than mere biological survival. If that was all life was about, then I suppose we could live our lives out in a windowless room 24 hours a day with somebody slipping cans of navy beans through a slot in the door. But no normal person would consider that living. Well, my estimation of mankind reached a new low after that. And I say that with no pleasure. I'm not naturally a misanthrope. It gives me no delight to say that I look at my fellow man now with profound disappointment and suspicion. I don't want that, but that's where I feel like I've been forced into. At that time, if you shared good news, people didn't want to hear it. Now, I don't know if you remember that, but in the first couple of months, like when Georgia reopened and there weren't corpses lining the side of the road, if you said, well, so far so good, that's good, it's like they didn't want the good news. They wanted Georgia to get what was coming to it for not obeying the public health bureaucracy. They wanted them to suffer. You know, when Sweden wasn't going along, the commentary on that was not, well, you know, Sweden may be doing something very, very risky here, but let's certainly hope for the best because we're all human beings and we wouldn't gratuitously wish harm on these people. That was not what they were saying. It was, they're going to get it. They said the same thing about Japan. Japan wasn't locking down hard enough, and it wasn't, well, look, let's all pray that it works out for them. No way! It was, they're gonna get it! That's not normal. That is not normal. And that's what we endured. I remember it because I was trying to share good news, and people were, it was absolutely bizarre. I remember 2020. We could sit here and tell stories all day. I'm going to tell you one story. 2021 in Virginia, we went to a deli, my wife and I. And you remember there was that time, like that 6 to 8 month period, where every establishment you went to, particularly convenience stores, you'd get to the door, and as you're approaching the door, there are like six signs on it. You think, oh, well, what's this one? I have this requirement, that requirement. It was like you have to wear a mask, and then you know, there'd be another one. We really mean it. You know, we're going to call somebody if you're not winning. I mean, it was just crazy. So we went to this deli, and sure enough, they had the crazy signs like, you must wear a mask. And it was mocking people for not wearing masks, saying, we're going to throw you out if you don't wear a mask. You open the door, and the distance from the door, then once you sat down, you could take your mask off and eat. The distance from the door to the tables was shorter than the distance between Dr. Malone and me right now. So they were that angry to make sure that I spent those two paces wearing a mask. That was how angry they were that I might not wear the mask for those two paces. That doesn't even make sense. There is no science about anything that would support that. But that was everywhere, the little crazy nonsense stories that we had to endure. Now, I have on my podcast, The Tom Woods Show, been happy to interview the authors of many good books on this subject. Well, it so happens I've written one of my own. Normally, I would hold it up for you, but it's called Diary of a Psychosis, and you can find copies of it, you know, at the event here, and I also have a website, diaryofcovid.com. But one of the features that makes the book different from some of the other treatments is that it's not made up of a series of bird's eye overview chapters, like a chapter on lockdowns, a chapter on masks, a chapter on the shot, something like that. It's not set up that way. I do cover all that, but since it is written in effect like a diary of somebody, myself, who was observing the craziness day after day, I also include these day-by-day little bits of madness. All these smaller bits of weirdness and insanity that historians might otherwise overlook. Because if you try to describe, let's say, to future generations what it was like to live through those years, it's insufficient simply to tell them the rules and regulations we were expected to observe. That's not enough. They need a tapestry. They need the texture of what life was like with just the crazy nuttiness, your crazy neighbor who made no sense and was yelling at you for heaven knows what. You need all of it. So for example, here, this is the sort of thing that when I tell it to you, some of you will remember it, but you had probably forgotten it. Old Woods doesn't forget here, okay? Woods wrote it all down. They're not going to just walk away from this. And it involves, now I know this is very low-hanging fruit, to criticize the World Economic Forum at the Mises Institute. I mean, this. I didn't tell you I was the bravest guy in the world. I just told you I wrote down a lot of crazy stuff. So the World Economic Forum published a tweet saying it was a tweet with a 1-minute video, and it was claiming that lockdowns are, quote, quietly improving cities around the world. Do you remember that, any of you? Quietly improving cities around the world. So what did we learn in the video? Well, lockdowns made cities a lot quieter. You don't say. We learned, see, there was less ambient noise, and this allowed scientists to detect earthquakes more efficiently. Now, I can't prove this. I recognize that. And so it's in some ways irresponsible of me to make this claim. But these people are from other planets, disguised as human beings. I mean, there's just no other explanation for how you'd say, well, yeah, everything that gives life meaning has been canceled, but we're 3% better at detecting earthquakes. No normal person thinks like this. They also said pollution went down a little bit. And then the video ended by asking, how quiet was your local area? And they honestly, because they're lizard people and not normal, they were expecting us to say, you know, doggone it, things sure were quiet around here. It was wonderful not hearing children playing or live music coming from clubs and restaurants or the hustle and bustle of a living city. How refreshing it was to experience a city with all the life and heart sucked out of it. But instead, nobody said that. In fact, the response was so bad, they had to take the darn thing down. These were truly bizarre times. Now, as I venture to begin to say something about bureaucracy per se, let me add a little addendum to your program. So on your program, there is a link next to each speaker, like a website. Mine is my Twitter handle, which you should follow me on that because I'm funny. My daughter Regina tells me that if people judged you on the basis of your Twitter feed, they would think you are a much nastier person than you really are. Because I'm a very lovely father and husband and friend, but my gosh, on that platform, it is just no mercy. So just, you've been warned. But I do want to say that there is a website I'd like to recommend to you for me that you could jot down there. And it's this. It's woodshistory.com, woodshistory.com. For years and years, I've had two U.S. history courses where a couple of colleagues and I teach U.S. history the way we would teach it if we were in charge of things. Let's just say you'll learn a lot more in these courses than you will in, you know, the standard one. And that used to be behind a paywall. There was no way for you to get access to that without paying for it. But now you can have them for free. And your kids can use them, like probably high school. You, as you're driving around, can enjoy them. But you can have them for nothing at woodshistory.com. All right. Now, this being a Mises Institute event, and it's on the bureaucracy, I decided that in advance of this event, I would reread Ludwig von Mises' 1944 book, published by Yale University Press, if you can believe that. It was a different world in those days, simply called Bureaucracy. And I wanted to apply it to the public health bureaucracy under COVID. That just seems like tailor-made for me. So Mises in that book identifies fundamental problems with bureaucracy that make bureaucratic management both inefficient and arbitrary, and also comparable to the problems faced by pure socialism. Now, by pure socialism, we don't mean Denmark and Sweden. Pure socialism is collective ownership of the means of production. And the problem, as the Misesians in the room may well know, with pure socialism, according to Mises, is not the problem most people think it is. Most people think, if I live in a society based on equality, why would I work hard if they're going to distribute the money equally? That's not the main problem. The main problem is much more fundamental. And it's a problem that bureaucracies in their own way also have to overcome. So the problem that a planning board in a socialist society tries in vain to solve is this, that if one entity owns all the means of production, so that would be capital goods, factories, all these sorts of things, it's impossible to engage in economizing behavior. Because if one entity owns it all, there's no buying and selling. Why would there be buying and selling? You already own everything. And without buying and selling, there are no prices, because prices emerge from the process of buying and selling. And without prices, all of our allocation decisions are arbitrary and wasteful. The money prices that buying and selling give rise to are the means by which we are able to calculate profit and loss, to compare the value of the outputs of a production process with the cost of the inputs used to make them. And that way we can see when we're wasting resources. That's what losses means. At that point, we either stop or modify what we're doing. Or when we're earning profits and thereby we learn that we've been adding value for society, we continue or even expand what we're doing. So every bureaucracy is in a similar kind of situation. A bureaucracy generates no sales revenue. It's given a budget that comes from taxes, but it's not generating sales revenue, so it's not getting feedback from the public. And so it can't calculate profit and loss. It can't tell us whether what it's doing is value productive for consumers and society. It has no way of knowing which of its activities add value and which of its activities delete value. It's all arbitrary. Now, of course, it knows that it can do more if it spends more money. We all know that. But it has no way of calculating whether, from the point of view of society, the most value-productive use of the money in question lies in the further expansion of that bureaucracy's activities as opposed to some other course of action. So these are the kinds of problems that face what we might call mundane bureaucracies, like the Department of Motor Vehicles or the Sewer Department. And these seem to be mostly what Mises has in mind. But the public health bureaucracy is of a different caliber from these. The public health bureaucracy, unlike the Department of Motor Vehicles, is at its root ideological. Now, if I had said that in 1880, no one would have understood what I meant. Because in 1880, the primary concern of the public health bureaucracy was getting the horse manure off the streets. And, imagine living in an old time when there was a bureaucracy you could actually agree with. Yeah, you know what? As a matter of fact, I do want to get the horse manure off the streets. That I'm on board with. There's nothing really ideological about that. But if you look at the current public health bureaucracy, it is ideological to its core. And our dear friend Tom DiLorenzo wrote a book 25 years ago called From Pathology to Politics, Public Health in America, in which he laid out the ideological bent of the public health establishment. And if you read that book, you would not have been surprised at all by one iota of how that establishment handled the COVID matter. So when Tom is not busy predicting the future, he's, you know, doing the mundane tasks of running the Mises Institute, but he also has this talent of seeing the future. And he does see the future in that book from 25 years ago. And don't forget, we've lived through it just in the past few years. Don't forget, racism is a public health emergency. That's an ideological statement. Or gun violence is a public health emergency, and therefore we have to implement all the left-wing responses to that. Or if you go to conferences of you know, big public health associations, you will look at the program, and no doubt you'll find a handful of physicians, but it is not uncommon or out of the ordinary or unheard of that your keynote speaker will be the head of the AFL-CIO, which has nothing to do with anything if we're talking about public health. But public health will say things like, well, we need to have a redistributive welfare state because that contributes to health. And so it's you can already see where all this is going. The policies they recommend really are not coming from a place of health. They're coming from a place of very, very predictable, typical left-wing ideology. So the problem that we need to fear from the public health bureaucracy is not so much this Misesian one that it's going to use resources arbitrarily because it has no consumer feedback. It's more the complete unresponsiveness to the public and its dedication to rule following. Mises emphasizes that bureaucracies are all about following the rules, which, by the way, this is how left-wing radicals used to try to break aspects of society they didn't like. Like in the 60s, they wanted welfare payments to be made much, much more liberally. So they overwhelmed the bureaucracy. They just overwhelmed them with cases of people coming in, and they didn't know what to do, so they just liberalized the whole process. They understood that bureaucracies are rule followers. And so you're going to find that bureaucracies are not responsive to changing conditions. So if the rule says you have to wear a mask and there is no evidence this does anything, this has no effect on them. It has no effect, nothing. They don't have to worry that the public might be getting antsy or upset. They don't have to respond to them. They have no need to respond to public unhappiness. So in this case, we had a bureaucracy overseeing a destructive campaign that harmed people's health, their financial and emotional well-being, and the normal functioning of society. But even then, no market feedback mechanism existed that could make them stop. Now, a good portion of the altogether justified complaints against the public health bureaucracy involved its disregard for the collateral damage of its COVID-19 monomania. And as we'll see in a few moments, this horrific problem was entirely predictable and would not have surprised Ludwig von Mises at all. So-called public health purported to be protecting the public against a deadly disease, but it generally failed even to acknowledge the many collateral harms done to society, harms that are so well known as hardly to need mentioning, but which, for the sake of completeness, I shall briefly catalog. The collateral effects on society of these radical interventions can probably never be fully calculated. And some of them, like the way these policies ruined friendships, pitted family members against one another, cannot be quantified in the first place. In some countries, 2 years went by with no education of any kind for children, not Zoom school, nothing, nothing. In Myanmar, we heard stories of people resorting to eating snakes and rats. What was done to Africa, which was a crime against humanity all its own, and I recommend a book by a leftist, incidentally, named Toby Green, The book is called The COVID Consensus, and it's about the lockdown policies as crimes against the poorest peoples and countries. Kevin Bardosh did a very comprehensive review of the lockdown harms and summarized them this way. The promotion of lengthy social distancing restrictions by governments and scientific experts during the COVID crisis had severe consequences for hundreds of millions of people. Many original predictions are broadly supported by the cumulative research data presented above: a rise in non-COVID excess mortality, mental health deterioration, child abuse and domestic violence, widening global inequality, large increases in debt, food insecurity, lost educational opportunities, unhealthy lifestyle behaviors, increased loneliness and social polarization, democratic backsliding, and human rights violations. The pandemic response leaves behind a legacy of all these things. The National Bureau of Economic Research says that the lockdown unemployment shock, well, what they mean by lockdown unemployment shock is the tens of millions of people suddenly thrown out of work, that is projected to result in somewhere between 840,000 and 1.22 million excess deaths over the next 15 to 20 years. The New York Times, as a direct result of the lockdowns, conceded that there would be 1.4 million excess tuberculosis deaths, 500,000 excess HIV deaths, and 385,000 malaria deaths due to complications emanating from the lockdowns. Now, during the COVID years, we heard all kinds of state propaganda about social distancing and masks and why your kids can't play on the playground. But what we did not hear were stories about people who suffered under those restrictions, and there were more of them than we can possibly count. I had people writing to me on a daily basis because they received my email newsletter, and I was spending that email newsletter in these days writing about what was going on. And they would write to tell me about families pitted against themselves, about devastated careers, missed surgeries, loved ones forced to die alone. They would write to me about isolation and grief and frustration and loneliness and sadness and incredulity that any of this could be happening in the first place. And they wrote to me, a total stranger, because they felt like I was the only person who could understand what they were even talking about. They couldn't talk to their neighbors and friends. They couldn't say anything in public. The media had no sympathy for them. That was what we endured. Now, at my diaryofcovid.com, if you get the book, Diary of a Psychosis, go to diaryofcovid.com and you can claim as one of your bonuses, I have a second volume called Collateral Damage. And it's a series of real life stories of people who just want to be heard. At this point, that's all they can hope for. They just want to be heard of what they endured. We weren't allowed to talk about this because you wanted to kill your grandmother, or you just wanted to go get a sandwich or get a haircut. That was the way people were treated. Now, none of this would have surprised Mises. Mises explained all the way back in that book in 1944 that it was in the nature of bureaucracy itself to neglect collateral effects and instead to focus obsessively on whatever the area of immediate concern was. So here's Mises. Governments encourage the specialists who limit their observations to a narrow field without bothering about the further consequences of a policy. The labor economist deals only with the immediate results of pro-labor policies. The farm economist only with the rise of agricultural prices. Today, in most countries, each department follows its own course, working against the endeavors of the other departments. The Department of Labor aims at higher wage rates and at lower living costs. But the same administration's Department of Agriculture aims at higher food prices, and the Department of Commerce tries to raise domestic commodity prices by tariffs. One department fights against monopoly, but other departments are eager to bring about, by tariffs, patents, and other means, the conditions required for the building of monopolistic restraint. And each department refers to the expert opinion of those specialized in their respective fields. Now, I do want to point out, last year I had the opportunity, I thought, to debate this subject on stage live with an opponent. And the resolution was something like, the COVID restrictions introduced by governments around the world were very helpful in protecting public health. And obviously, I took the negative on that. And we were, and I was supposed to debate somebody from the American Enterprise Institute, which is supposed to be free market, but they are unreliable, let's say, those people, unreliable. And my opponent had a terrible, terrible, unspeakable family tragedy occur just 2 days before the debate. And I couldn't reschedule, so what we did was he sent in his opening statement in written form, and our wonderful host, Gene Epstein, read his opening statement, and then I read my opening statement, and then we just had an evening of questions. So it wasn't quite what I'd hoped for. But I couldn't help wondering, what could he possibly say? I have all the evidence in the world. Like, that book is full of charts and graphs and numbers and stories that cannot be reconciled with the all this stuff did a whole lot of good story. So what could he possibly say? So I worried about it. I thought, is it possible that I've just overlooked slam dunk arguments the other side has? I genuinely wondered. Well, we arrived. And of course, the person arguing the affirmative goes first. So Gene stood up there in the stead of this debater and read the opening statement. And I sat there with my legal pad and ready to take notes for how I was going to respond. And I listened and listened and listened. By three quarters of it through, I put my pen down and I said to my wife, this is not going to be a problem. It was all hot air. It was all hot air. There was one chart that might have been a little challenging, but not impossible to overcome. There wasn't anything. And I think even some critics of lockdowns and stuff in the back of their minds may have thought, maybe these people aren't stupid. I mean, they may be sinister, but they're not stupid. Maybe they have some argument that I don't know. Well, here I was up there ready to debate, and there weren't any. Well, this wasn't the first time this happened. This was not the first time that somebody like this was put on the spot and couldn't come up with an argument. I don't know if you remember the name Andy Slavitt, but yeah, okay, because we're nerds in here. Some of us know Andy Slavitt. He was a White House COVID advisor. Oh, like the lowest of the low. Like, could there be a job title worse than that? So Andy Slavitt goes on MSNBC. Can you believe, not Fox News, MSNBC. They asked him, you know, look, this doesn't seem to be accomplishing anything because Florida and California seem to be about the same. And yet California is absurdly locked down. In Florida, people are going to concerts and comedy clubs, and it seems to be like no big difference. Like, what is going on here? And by the way, when all was said and done at the end of it, Florida did better in terms of all-cause mortality during those years. You know, I mean, like that shouldn't have been possible if these bureaucrats were telling us the truth. So now here's the opportunity, right? Andy Slavitt, here's his opportunity to explain to us why the evidence of our senses doesn't really count. I mean, this is his chance. He's one of the geniuses who secretly has good arguments. Let's hear what they are. Quote, look, there's so much of this virus that we think we understand, that we think we can predict, that's just a little bit beyond our explanation. So you know what? The SOBs didn't have an argument after all. They didn't. You know, like maybe we were a little intimidated because they have all these fancy degrees. No, they didn't have an argument. When they asked Anthony Fauci, look, Texas just reopened and there don't seem to be corpses piling up on the side of the road. What do you think's going on there? And his answer was, well, it's hard to compare one state to another, you know, usual. And then it was, maybe they're, these are his exact words, maybe they're doing things outdoors. Maybe they just took Texas and brought it outside. That was it. Like, he had, like, so if we're thinking, but these people are smart, maybe they got something. They got nothing. And so what do you know? If you tried to talk about what was going on, you got suppressed. You got suppressed because they had, it wasn't that you were full of falsehoods and conspiracies and these smart people had all the answers. They had nothing. They had nothing. However, in keeping with the bureaucracy, the rules aren't accomplishing anything other than destruction, but We have to stick with them. Here's going back to Andy Slavitt again. We're going to stick with them anyway. I just told you they don't do anything, but here's what I also say. Quote, what we do know is that the more careful people are, the more they mask and social distance, and the quicker we vaccinate, the quicker it goes away and the less it spreads. But we've got to get better visibility into variants. We don't know what role they play, large events, etc. As we have all learned by this time, this is a virus that continues to surprise us. That's their excuse. It's very hard to predict yet. Well, not really. It does the exact opposite of what you say. And all around the country, we've got to do a better job, and I think we are, but we're not done yet. That's his answer. That's not an answer. You know, sorry we decimated your savings and took away your sources of joy and destroyed your business and stole a year or two of your children's lives. We're just learning, you see, you know? But you graph the results any way you like, by lockdown stringency, by people's mobility patterns, by mask mandate dates, whatever. The results are completely random. They do not show any clear pattern whereby ruining your life does anything. But they're going to stick. They're going to stick with it. You can chart the results of the 25 most lockdown states versus the 25 most lenient ones, and it's the same line. That should not be possible if what they were telling us had been the truth. Now, there's plenty more we can say about bureaucracy that rings true when we apply it to public health. Bureaucracies are rigid. And as I say, they prioritize compliance with rules. Mises explains why that must be so. Here we are simply stating that it is so. Likewise, bureaucracies seek to expand their scope and justify their existence, often exaggerating problems or creating new ones to maintain relevance and power. Here's Mises. The bureaucrat's opportunity to derive profit from his activities is much greater than that of the average citizen. Every expansion of government activities increases his chances for promotion and power. And wow, was this an opportunity to do precisely that. I mean, inflexibility, an obsession with rule following and grasping for more power, that sounds a teensy-weensy bit like what we observed during those years. I'll never forget Anthony Fauci being deeply, profoundly angry when a federal judge said, you don't have to wear masks on interstate travel, particularly airplanes anymore. He was so angry about that. And he said, the Department of Justice has nothing to do with this. This is a public health matter. So in his view, we should be living under a dictatorship of quote unquote public health. We shouldn't have these judges. Now, nobody complained at that time. Oh, he doesn't respect the separation of power. No, they only say that when it's the wrong ox being gored. They don't care about that principle. So he thought public health ought to be superior to the legal system. So, you know, that sounds a little bit to me like grasping for more power. And by the way, let's not be deceived. The reason they were afraid of the masks coming off on the planes was not that they thought we would all get sick. It was that they knew we would not get sick. And then we would start asking other questions. Well, but probably the most consistent offense of the public health bureaucracy was the nonstop spread of propaganda, even as it had the nerve to accuse other individuals and institutions of engaging in misinformation. But this, too, is to be expected from bureaucracy. Propaganda, wrote Mises, is one of the worst evils of bureaucracy and socialism. Propaganda is always the propaganda of lies, fallacies, and superstitions. Well, the greatest superstition of all was this. Follow the rules of the public health bureaucracy and things will go well for you. Despite the obvious uselessness of these rules, you'll avoid the plague. Disregard them and you'll get what's coming to you. Their supporters held a superstitious belief in what the state could accomplish. So if the state says it can protect you from a deadly pathogen and maintain your health, who's to say it can't? But the COVID situation was really perfect for the kind of people who tend to populate government agencies, particularly in the area of health. It involved so-called experts dictating to the stupid rubes. That's their preferred model of government right there. And it allows them to ridicule the working class people they despise. Why, if only these backward hicks would just follow the science, we'd be out of this already. Well, a couple more things before I close. I mentioned earlier on the case of Sweden. Now, they had a very interesting case there because they had a state epidemiologist who took something like the opposite view of what ought to be done, and it would take several years for him to be vindicated. Could you imagine an Anthony Fauci doing something that would take 3 years before he'd be vindicated for it? This guy can't go 3 days, you know, without being on the cover of some magazine, you know, posing in a, you know, $10,000 outfit or whatever. I mean, there's no way. I mean, he has to be loved. And yet, what ended up happening with Sweden? Best numbers on all-cause mortality in all of Europe. That shouldn't have been possible. Is there any one of these bureaucrats who in June of 2020 would have said Sweden will probably have the best death record of any country in Europe? Not one of them would have said that. Or Florida will do better than California? Not one of them would have said that. But what's the price? You know, what's the price that they paid for that? You know, most of them retired in comfort, as far as I can see. Well, I will say, though, that we tend to look at these things and become very black-pilled. Now, you may not all be familiar with the different color pills, but black-pilled means you have a profound pessimism about the present and future. White-pilled means you see signs of hope. Red and blue are different from these. In a recent podcast episode I did on the Tom Wood Show, I came up with gray-pilled because I think I feel gray-pilled. That I don't want to be a Pollyanna, but at the same time, I can't be one of those people who, like every day on my podcast, is grinding your head into the dirt with a boot. I just can't be that person. We have a lot of people, unfortunately, in our movement who they can't accept a win ever. They can't take yes for an answer. They can't take good news. Anytime something seems to go right, there's always something beneath it that's actually wrong. Can't do that. I don't have the energy for that. So I will conclude by pointing out that we have accomplished some things. We have accomplished some things just by being the people. The bureaucracy has a lot of advantages over us, including an endless supply of other people's money. But we, the disorganized masses, accomplished things. For example, those so-called vaccine passports that popped up in a number of American cities. You know for a fact they wanted to keep those in place in perpetuity. And they hardly lasted at all. Now, we all know that was not a health measure. I mean, come on, we all know that. That was not why they did that. And if you even need to see the numbers, I'm Mr. Numbers on this, and I can tell you, you look at LA County versus Orange County, the first one had the mandate, the second one didn't, the numbers are identical. No, they admit behind closed doors, and I have the quotations in the book, That was all about just forcing people to comply. It wasn't like we have to keep people safe, so we'll keep the unvaccinated away from them. Yeah, they said that for public consumption, but the real point was to make your life so miserable that you would just surrender. That was the point. And Dr. Jay Varma in New York, Dr. Jay Varma was the guy who appeared next to Andrew Cuomo every single day for that COVID briefing. He was on the TV every single day. Parentheses, then it came out that during that time, he was engaged in some highly unusual extracurricular activities of his own. That's not even my point. My point is that Steven Crowder got him on a hidden camera basically admitting that, yeah, we're not going to force people to take it. We're just going to make your life really, really hard if you don't. So he didn't say, well, we need to do this for their health. It's we need to make them comply. And enough of us didn't comply that the whole thing collapsed. And that's not a small thing. That's a miracle. After what was done to us, that's a miracle. And that should give us hope. That should turn that black pill into gray. That all is not lost. Who would have predicted in 2020 that one of the best known lockdown critics would be the director of the National Institutes of Health a few years later? No one would have predicted that. No one would have predicted that. So where it comes down to is we have more skeptics than ever of the official bureaucracies. Because what we observed during these crazy years, that stuff was not how decent and honest people running agencies aimed at improving the public welfare behave. And that's obvious to everybody. So we can run society according to the rules of private property and freedom, or we can run it by bureaucratic decree. And the COVID episode reminded us of just how important that choice is. Thank you very much.